Get ready for Malice, a twisted new drama starring Jack Whitehall, David Duchovny, and Carice Van Houten. Jack Whitehall plays Adam, a charming man who infiltrates the wealthy Tanner family with a hidden motive to destroy them. This edge-of-your-seat revenge thriller unravels a deliciously dark mystery in a world full of wealth, secrets, and betrayal. Malice will constantly keep you on your toes. Why is Adam after the Tanner family? What lengths will he go to? One thing's for sure, the past never stays buried, so keep your enemies close. Watch all episodes of Malice on November 14th, only on Prime Video.
Hi, I'm Mike Dilk, and you're listening to the Relax Back UK show, the show that explores all kinds of health topics relevant to you, your family, and your friends. Each week, I talk to expert guests from a range of backgrounds to inform and entertain you. So please do join the Relax Back UK family and stay tuned.
Hi, and thank you for joining me on the Relax Back UK show. Two topics this week, both below the belt.
One in three millennial men said pornography was the main source of their sex education.
My first guest is Dr. Aman Patel. He's a GP on embarrassing bodies and talks about men's health and sexual function. Then it's specialist prostate cancer nurse Sophie Smith.
50,000 men are diagnosed in the UK each year, and around 12,000 men will die from prostate cancer.
She talks about prostate cancer and the possibility of over-treatment. So please do stay tuned for an interesting and useful show. Thank you. Before the first guest, I've just got some news for you. The UK Health Radio Awards are now up and running. You can go to ukhealthradio.com, click on the award icon to vote. Lots of catalogues, including one for presenters. So if you like the Relax Back UK show, do go there, ukhealthradio.com, and vote for me, Mike Dilk, on the Relax Back UK show. Now, my first guest is Dr. Aman Patel. He's a specialist in sexual function and men's health. He's also on Embarrassing Bodies. So my first question to him was, is he on the TV right now? Is Embarrassing Bodies on at the moment?
No, so Embarrassing Bodies off telly at the moment. However, I'm off to film some Gone Fishing next week.
Gone Fishing?
Yeah, so Bob Mortimer and Paul Whitehouse basically fish, as the title suggests, and they talk about lots of surreal things because that's kind of Bob's deal. But they also talk about their health because I think the starting point of that program was the fact that both of them had heart problems and they thought they should get out and do something positive. Again, much like your founder of Health Radio decided actually lifestyle is really important about changing how you actually feel and your physical health, they decided that actually getting out there, doing some fishing together, having a laugh, being ridiculous, was a good thing to film.
That sounds great.
Yeah, it is great.
Have you ever gone fishing?
So I'm vegetarian, so I don't feel it's very fair. I mean, I know they throw most of the fish back, but I don't think it's particularly for me. But I'm very happy to support the health side of things.
Good. All right. Well, look, good luck with that. I hope that goes well. That I shall look out for that on the TV when it comes.
I think it'll be Christmas special, so I think Boxing Day.
All right. Good. But the topic today is anxiety, particularly in men, regarding sex and sexual health.
Yeah.
So I guess a good first question has got to be a pretty basic one, really. Is sex education at schools still happening? And, you know, is it doing what it should? Is it covering the topics that, you know, people would find useful and helpful?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. And I feel that education really is the starting point of where things aren't working as well as they might, but also the way that you could solve quite a lot of issues. I mean, if we think about particularly sex, the survey that Love Honey did showed that one in three millennial men said pornography was the main source of their sex education. Which is pretty disappointing, given that I wouldn't watch like pornography. You know, so I wouldn't watch James Bond to learn how to drive. So I wouldn't necessarily watch pornography in terms of learn how.
Or you wouldn't watch James Bond to learn how to be a spy.
Exactly. He does seem to look exactly the same. Well, I suppose his face changes every few movies. But yes, it's a very it's an incredible number of villains that seem to know who he is. But at any rate, pornography gives you an arousing structure to basically get you off, really. And that's what it's designed for. Unfortunately, it wasn't really designed to teach young people or people of any age how to have sex and what their bodies might look like if they don't look like a classical six-packed. Yeah. You know, Adonis.
It's not real life, is it?
Absolutely. Well, I mean,
in the same way, James Bond is not real life. You know.
Unless you happen to have a lot of pizza delivery people and plumbers coming to your home, it's not really real life at all. No.
So it kind of is. Well, that's all bound up with a lot of social media, I suppose. So yes. Is social media the kind of main cause of concern? You know, what's causing this kind of level of anxiety?
So if we look at the sort of amount of anxiety, so again, Love Honey did this survey and they were trying to get a snapshot of what men of all ages are feeling at the moment. And they found that 8 in 10 British men say they've got worries about sex and relationships. And that number goes even higher in younger generations. So 86% of Gen Z men said the same thing, that they've got anxiety about sex and relationships. So if that's the case, and it's more the younger that you are, it's about investigating, well, why might young people more than older men have more anxieties? And certainly we know that the advent of the internet has changed the game in terms of how people communicate, in terms of how people experience culture, about how they ask questions. You know, before you might have surreptitiously gone to a library or asked a mate, and that was
a library. What's that?
Well, exactly. That's why I'm showing my age, aren't I?
Right? Yeah, that's a whole other series, actually. We should talk about libraries another time. But anyway, sorry, carry on.
No, that's right. But now, again, you go on your social media, which I totally get because everyone's got access to it. But young people are particularly more able on social media because they've grown up with it. I didn't get my first mobile phone till I was 24. However, if you've had one since you're 8 or 10 or whatever, you're so bonded to your phone and you know how to access all of the social media. You're on all these sites that allow you to connect with so many different people across the world. You have the ability to get so much information at your fingertips. So in some ways, it's amazing. But in other ways, unfortunately, it's become a significant source of distress for some people. They look at the successful lives that people are demonstrating, and that's the key word. It's sort of show and tell rather than actually the reality of it. And they see people in fast cars. They see people in these incredible relationships with these incredible bodies, purportedly having incredible sex lives. And they think, oh, what's wrong with me? Why don't I look like that? Why don't I experience life like that? Why aren't I rich like that? Why don't I have those clothes? And unfortunately, you can get stuck in a bit of an echo chamber because the algorithms kind of feed you what you're looking at. So if you're worried about acne, you're going to get more acne stuff. If you're worried about fertility, it'll be more fertility stuff. And some of the people giving the information aren't necessarily any type of expert in the field. And don't get me wrong, I very much support the use of peer experts. And so these are patients that have got the illness and they're able to talk about it with real skill. But a lot of people online are simply talking about stuff that doesn't necessarily have a huge evidence base, like mouth taping, or in relationships they're suggesting that X and Y might save your relationship, or a particular type of vegetable might solve your erectile problems, and it's just not true in the majority of cases. Yeah.
Something that I'm always coming up against is this is kind of potentially indicative of a wider problem in health, in that people get an awful lot of health advice, not just sexual health advice, but about everything online, and particularly young people. And there was a statistic, I can't remember what it was, but it was the number of young people that get health information from TikTok as opposed to health information from their GP.
Yeah.
And that is a serious problem.
Yeah, I don't think it's ideal. I mean, I think there's two bits to it, isn't it? There's like the fact that we are less knowledgeable about sex and have all these questions, and who do we have to ask, and what information are we given as a young person, when, you know, some schools don't even have to deliver sex education. And I think that's kind of criminal, because, you know, a young person not understanding how their body works is the first step in kind of, you know, living your life. And the fact that you're not taught that your body has the ability for pleasure if you want to use it and how to use it, rather than terrifying young people that all they're going to do is get pregnant or have STIs and how we can stop that. So I think that's a problem. But equally, we're recognising, particularly in Love Honey's study, that a third of their Gen Z and millennial men had actually turned to AI to ask for sex and relationship advice. So you're thinking that actually, if it's replacing these traditional sources of information, which also may not have been brilliant, because often people ask their mates, or their mates are telling them about their sexual achievements or what sex life should be like, because they're getting it from AI, they feel it's a verified source. But unfortunately, we also know that AI is only as good as the information that's put in it. And it can be subject to hallucinations where it kind of just makes stuff up to fill a gap. So I think ideally what I'd like is for young people to be more inquisitive and questioning. And they are in loads of ways. And, you know, there are, you know, I'm actually very positive about the young generation. They're so much more functional in so many ways. And they feel like they have the skills to talk about these things, but they still don't seem to. So there's still a considerable problem.
Are there any online sources that could be trusted? What about my old favourite, anyway, the NHS website?
So, I mean, I'm always a big fan of that. You know, as a GP, I'm always sending information on that website, particularly if people, you know, having issues with sexual problems, HRT, you know, all of these, testosterone deficiency, all of these things that they might want to talk about. But equally, there are also lots of good charities that kind of work and talk about sex. For example, for young people, Brook, a great Young Minds for Mental Health, to try and support people through what is a difficult time. I mean, the world is very anxiety-provoking, and the fact that social media, the news, brings it to the fore because the algorithm kind of rewards stressful content. And whether that's positively stressful or negatively stressful, it doesn't matter. So if you're watching all of this stuff, it makes you feel that the world is very close by and it has a very intimate impact on our stress levels, our cortisol levels, which then can have a profound impact on our health. So it's kind of like, can we learn to just zoom out a bit, take in the world as a whole, be outside more, be with our friends more, be more socially connected, be more, you know, community connected, rather than focusing internally and our specific relationship with our phones.
Yeah. I mean, there are some professions that have protected titles. I mean, like, you're a doctor and, you know, you've earned the right to call yourself a doctor. If I suddenly started calling myself a doctor and selling advice online, you know, hopefully I'd be arrested, or, you know, something bad would happen. But could I call myself, you know, a sexual consultant or something and advertise my services online and charge people for advice?
I mean, the Guru Mike sex specialist could exactly exist in that way online. And I think that's what lots of people do. Lots of people now seem to have opinions. I mean, I used to be worried because I look at social media going, I don't understand how many people have so many opinions on so much stuff. There's loads of things that I don't feel I am fully educated on enough to be able to give my opinion. Geopolitics, for example. You wouldn't ask me, you'd ask Rory Stewart or, you know, someone else like that. But I do think there's the ability for people to sell themselves.
I might ask you about fishing now. But anyway, sorry, carry on.
No, but you see what I mean? I mean, that's why I was just like, look, I'm happy to say what I don't know. But the problem is, if you are specialising in selling yourself, which is what an influencer is in some ways, there are some that feel very authentic, right? And they feel like they actually are on your side and they want to give you the best health information. And that's what I really like people to do, is kind of go, be a bit inquisitive. Is this person being paid for this ad? Is this person being this bit of information? Is it something that benefits them? Or is it something that's actually helpful information? Where are they getting the information from? And can I just get another sense checking it from maybe like an NHS website that will have the evidence listed, yeah, or maybe looking at the background survey, you know, check, is the survey actually based on anything, or was it like 12 people in a room?
So yeah, bear in mind that they might be trying to sell you something, etc., or just not know what they're talking about. So with that in mind, what is the kind of craziest, scariest, possibly most dangerous rubbish that you've come across people trying to peddle or suggest, probably on the internet?
I mean, I think the stuff about anabolic steroids worries me a lot, because now approximately 1 in 6 men in the UK, I saw a statistic recently, have used anabolic steroids. And the fact that it seems to be coming quite mainstream.
Is this people using steroids to try and get more muscular?
To get buff up, because they've watched a lot of stuff on social media, they've watched a lot of clips on people in the gym, influencers, you know, posting their incredible bodies. You know, people often being quite honest about it, saying, look, this is a diet of broccoli and chicken, and this is me working out 8 times a week. So this is how you achieve this. There's lots of, denial that I'm doing to myself to get this body. But other people going, you can just take this tablet or you can take this supplement. And that I find really distressing and really problematic. Because people are kind of wanting shortcuts now. They want to kind of bypass the work and go, let's just take this pill. And certainly my godson, who's 16, was talking about this new medication that fat strips you, but equally allows you to gain muscle mass. And I'd never heard of it. And he said all of his friends are talking about it and some are thinking about taking it. I actually looked at the evidence. It can decrease your fertility. It can cause lots of other significant problems. And these can be permanent. But these young people are being exposed to this and knowing about it at the drop of a hat, much faster than I'll know about it as a sort of fuddy-duddy doctor. When I work in the space, but I kind of am getting into contact with more and more stuff that profoundly changes people's bodies permanently. Even things like hair loss medication can have profound implications for fertility, but then being peddled to everyone. I mean, obviously, I have no hair, so I get a lot of hair loss adverts, but I'm way too far along for treating them. I need a wig more than anything else if I wanted to do anything. But these young people understand the worry about their hairlines. They're seeing all their stars having, you know, hair transplants. You're seeing them take all these medications to retain their hairlines. This is what causes me to pause, because they're not always going through, well, what might happen to me if I take this medication for a while?
Yeah. I have to say, it worries me a lot as well. The whole what we should do about it, again, will probably be another series involving IT experts and goodness knows what. But probably a sensible way to bring this little conversation to an end would be, if people are genuinely, concerned, and they have questions, and maybe, well, what is the advice? Should they go and see their GP? You know, if they are suffering, and you know that maybe they've got erectile problems or worried about painful sex, what is their best course of action?
Absolutely. And I fully appreciate when I say this, that I know the access in the NHS is a challenge, and it can be difficult to get an appointment. However, I would say that the GP is probably the best place to start. If they don't know the answer themselves, because lots of doctors haven't been trained in sexual function. I mean, I had to get a separate postgraduate exams in it to know anything about it. It wasn't really taught at university, and it isn't part of the GP curriculum. So that's why I want to first put out there, going, actually, don't necessarily expect your GP to be most knowledgeable about it. However, expect them to be able to signpost you to sensible locations for information, or refer you to people like psychosexual therapists who can help you through the psychology of sexual problems, or to a urologist who specialises in men's health, genital problems. So you know, there's always people that can help you. So first of all, you know, do access healthcare. The second thing is safe spaces for men to talk about sex. You know, that could be a partner, that could be friends, it could be healthcare professionals, it could be groups. And the idea is trying to find people online or in the local environment that you feel comfortable talking to. And the first step is finding one person you trust. It could be an uncle and aunt, it could be someone in a parental role, it could be, so, you know, I appreciate it's difficult talking to your parents about sex, but it could be, for example, your friends that you trust. And if you're able to do that and they don't weaponize your health problem, because, you know, we know people can do that through humor or however they do it, but it can still be painful. You're just looking after your health and relationships. You know, your sex life is just the same as high blood pressure, which is just the same, for example, as obesity or any other issue. If you are worried about it and it's causing an impact on your physical or mental health or both, go and talk about it. You deserve the help for it. You shouldn't think that I need to man up about it, which is such a horrible thing to think about it. Just go and get it. Go and talk about it.
Excellent. That sounds like very good advice. So I think that's probably an excellent place to finish things. So many thanks for taking the time to chat.
Thank you so much, Mike, for having me on.
A little more news for you. As well as having the perfect face for radio, I've also got the perfect body for radio. And actually, I've decided to do something about it because I really need to lose a couple of stone, really, quite a few pounds. I have an exercise bike, and I've started an exercise bike regime, and you can join me if you like on my Relax Back UK YouTube channel on Tuesdays, Thursdays and Friday at 12:30. I'm going to be going for a bit of a pedal. I'm going to be doing this exercise regime from Watt Bike, but you don't have to do that. You can just come along and watch or pedal at your own speed, whatever you fancy. So if you do want to come, it'll be absolutely lovely to see you there.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Get ready for Malice, a twisted new drama starring Jack Whitehall, David Duchovny, and Carice Van Houten. Jack Whitehall plays Adam, a charming Manny infiltrates the wealthy Tanner family with a hidden motive to destroy them. This edge-of-your-seat revenge thriller unravels a deliciously dark mystery in a world full of wealth, secrets, and betrayal. Malice will constantly keep you on your toes. Why is Adam after the Tanner family? What lengths will he go to? One thing's for sure, the past never stays buried, so keep your enemies close. Watch all episodes of Malice on November 14th, only on Prime Video.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
My next guest is Sophie Smith, a specialist prostate cancer nurse. And my first questions are, what is prostate cancer? How many people does it kill? And how many people are diagnosed?
Yeah, so prostate cancer is obviously a cancer of the prostate. So it affects men or people that have a prostate. It is the most common cancer now around. So it affects
even around, more common than breast cancer.
Yeah. So it's the most common cancer. Yeah, most common cancer in the UK. So it affects around 50,000 men are diagnosed in the UK each year, and around 12,000 men will die from prostate cancer as well every year. So it's a big thing that men do need to be aware of.
And are those numbers going up? Mm-hmm. Stable? No, they're going up.
Yeah, they're going up, and it's going to be one of those things that keeps increasing, and it's also one of those things as well. It's the biggest cancer, and also the biggest cancer that also doesn't have a screening program, as well. So we have screening programs, as we know, for breast cancer and lung cancer, but we don't have a screening program for prostate cancer. So it's one of those things that as Prostate Cancer UK, the charity, that we've been kind of banging the drum about for many, many years now, to try and get this changed.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there has been a lot of drum banging going on, and I think probably most men, unless they really sort of ignore all the news and all the media, which is possible, we're always told of some of the symptoms. And if we're at all worried about any of the symptoms, get yourself down to the doctor kind of the next day. So kind of, I suppose, the question that comes out of that, what are the potential symptoms that us men need to be wary of?
Yeah, and we talk about symptoms, but actually prostate cancer can be symptomless, and most commonly prostate cancer is symptomless, and the symptoms can come from other things to do with your prostate, like aging and getting a bigger prostate, which cause symptoms. So yes, symptoms can be something to look out for. So symptoms like needing to go to the toilet more frequently, so getting up in the night, going more frequently, having a poor flow.
Blood I'm 59, and it's not uncommon for me to need to get up in the night and go for a pee. Mm-hmm. But I kind of take that as just part of life because I'm 59.
Yeah, and getting up once in the night is very normal. You know, that's normal as you get older to maybe get up once in the night. But it's when it becomes bothersome, so you're maybe getting up 2-3 times a night, that's a bothersome symptom that you would need to be able to go and get checked out. So changes to normal routine, changes to your norm would be something to go and get checked if it's happening, you know, more frequently, and you're going to the toilet, you know, much more frequently. Every couple of hours, you're finding that you're going to the toilet. But as I say, actually, prostate cancer is symptomless. So you could have prostate cancer that's growing that you know nothing about. So that's why it's really important to actually know your risk of prostate cancer. And your risks include getting older. So from the age of 50, your risk will start to increase. Having a black ethnicity, it doubles your risk. So 1 in 8 men get prostate cancer in their lifetime, but actually for a black ethnicity, that increases to 1 in 4. So it really increases your risk if you are of a black ethnicity. And also having a family history, you're 2.5 times more likely to get prostate cancer if you have a father or a brother that has prostate cancer. And if you're in that bracket, we would say to start thinking about your risk from 45 instead of 50. So really knowing your risks, and then speaking to your GP, because there is no screening program about your prostate health is more important than actually waiting for a symptom to develop.
And then what is the GP likely to do?
Well, the first step is a PSA blood test. So that is a test that, whilst it can't diagnose prostate cancer, which is why we don't have this screening program, because the PSA blood test, it isn't a foolproof test. It can't say, yes, you have prostate cancer, no, you don't have prostate cancer. So it can raise that red flag that you could have a problem with your prostate. And then that first initial PSA blood test that your GP can do can then lead on, if it is raised, if it could show that there could be a problem in your prostate, the next step is then an MRI scan that you would then get done to look in more detail at your prostate. And these are some of the more significant changes that have happened over the years, that have been able to lead on to, you know, now potentially looking at whether or not a screening program is now being able to be implemented.
Right. So, I mean, for pretty much every cancer, we're told get diagnosed early and get it sorted before it gets bad and before it spreads or whatever. Now, that generally seems like a very good plan. And, you know, the medical world has been quite good at getting that through to most people. Is that sort of message not potentially 100% the way to go with prostate cancer? Because as a very typical bloke, you know, if I get diagnosed with something, particularly cancer, prostate cancer, I'd be thinking, right, let's get this sorted tomorrow.
Yeah, and this is the difficulty with prostate cancer. It's a really, really tricky cancer, because whilst, yes, there are some prostate cancers that we absolutely want to diagnose and we need to find early and treat so that it will benefit a man and therefore not kill a man. You know, we talk about these 12,000 men that are dying from prostate cancer. But actually, there are lots of prostate cancers that potentially would never cause a man harm in his lifetime. So this is where prostate cancer is a really, really tricky disease and almost a disease of two halves, really. and so there are many prostate cancers that actually men don't need to know about and we want to leave alone. And this is where it is understanding kind of the benefits and harms of finding out whether or not you have a potential prostate cancer and starting that process.
Are there different types of prostate cancer? Because, I mean, there are different types of many other cancers. Is that the truth of prostate?
Well, there are, but there is one main type of prostate cancer, but we have a different grade. It's a different grades of prostate cancer. So we have slow-growing prostate cancer, and then we have faster growing prostate cancer. So it's kind of graded on a scaling system called a Gleason score. And so that scaling system tells us whether or not we have slow growing cancer or whether or not we have this faster growing prostate cancer. And that tells us whether or not we have something that is potentially not going to cause a man any harm in his lifetime, or something that is more aggressive and something that potentially could cause a man more harm.
So how can you know which one someone has?
By doing a biopsy. So that's kind of the next stage after you've had a PSA test. Maybe that raises a red flag. You then go on to have an MRI scan. Maybe that shows an area of concern in a prostate. The next stage after that is a biopsy. So taking samples out of the prostate to find whether or not then there are these, looking at the cells under a microscope to be able to tell whether or not there is this Gleason score to look at those cells to see whether or not you have any slow growing, well, you could have no cancer, or whether or not you have slow growing cells or faster growing cells, looking at this Gleason score.
Okay. Taking a biopsy. Now that sounds a bit scary because, you know, a lot of the time you take a biopsy, it's somewhere near the surface and you kind of get attable. Prostate isn't that easy to get at, generally speaking, for a quick biopsy.
You're absolutely right. Yeah, you're absolutely right. It's quite deep kind of in the pelvis, although it is still nearer the surface, but obviously it's where it is on a man. And I think that's also, we work on a helpline at Prostate Cancer UK as specialist nurses. And that's kind of one of the main calls we often get is, you know, I've heard all about these biopsies and they, you know, people tell me how scary it is and how horrible it's been. But it's a quick 10-minute procedure. And something that men obviously up and down the country undergo every day. And it's not as scary as it does sound. Yeah, it is very safe now. Most commonly it's done now through the surface of the skin between where the testicles are and the back passage. And it's done with, you know, a local anaesthetic, and that's the worst part, putting local anaesthetic in. And then the needles are put in through that way. So, of course, it's not pleasant, but it is necessary to find out whether or not, you know, if you've got these red flags being raised that you could have cancer, the only way to find out is by doing this biopsy. And obviously then that is necessary to find out, you know, what's going on in your prostate.
And in the general scheme of things, you know, that is quite unpleasant for 10 minutes, but compared with, you know, potentially having an aggressive prostate cancer, it's an easy choice to make, I would suggest.
Yeah, absolutely. And the anxiety then of not knowing, you know, some men might choose not to have it done. And obviously that's always a choice for men to make. But then the anxiety of not knowing what is going on in your prostate obviously leads to lots of worry and concern as well. So as you say, that 10-minute procedure of it being unpleasant the infection risks now are much, you know, are much lower. And that was always the concern when they were going through the back passage into the prostate, because you're going through a dirty to a clean place. It's now much safer by doing it, as we call, the perineal route. So you're going through the skin surface into the prostate is a much safer way. And that's most commonly how it's done now.
Yeah. I'm a fairly regular sort of bloke, I like to think. Now, if I had this concern and had a biopsy and it came back, said, well, actually, you know what? It's not that aggressive. It's just kind of a regular, fairly happy, if that's the right term, prostate cancer. I must admit, my first thought would be, okay, that's very nice to know, but let's just do something about it now anyway. Let's err on the side of safety. Now, is that a sensible thought?
Yeah, and this is where we get into this kind of discussion of over-treatment and whether or not men are being over-treated for prostate cancer that don't need treatment and are treating a prostate cancer because of the worry, because you've got cancer. And I think that, you know, you hear the word cancer and you automatically, you know, you've probably known somebody that's died of cancer. You know, cancer's all around us. And that's the difference with prostate cancer and knowing that we have these slow growing prostate cancers that might never cause a man harm in his lifetime. And this is where there is most men, you know, and a lot of men will be diagnosed with the cancer that will then have a lot of treatment options. So they might be told that they could monitor this cancer called active surveillance. And they could also then have surgery or maybe radiotherapy as well. So they could be given a whole host of treatment options to choose. And again, that's one of the most common things that men are calling our helpline for, is to understand all of these treatment options. And it is, are you treating something because of your anxiety around, I've got cancer, so I need to treat it, over the fact of actually you've not got a cancer that actually needs any treatment at the moment? And active surveillance is a very safe way of, it's still a treatment. You know, you're being monitored, you're having PSA tests regular, you're having an MRI scan regular, you know, and it is still a safe way of monitoring your cancer. Mm-hmm. And then you can have treatment at a point that maybe, if the cancer might never change, it might never grow to a point that you ever need treatment. it might do, and then that's the point that you could have curative treatment. Sure. But it's that monitoring process to not over-treat at a point that actually you don't need it.
And let's face it, there are going to be some downsides of treatment, whether the treatment is surgery or whatever. So it might be worth just highlighting some potential downsides of the various treatments.
And this is the point, and I think this is the point that men maybe sometimes don't understand. It's not like having something, as you said earlier, about having a biopsy and having something that's on the skin surface that you can quickly remove. The prostate is very close to many other structures within your pelvis, your bladder, your bowel, and your erectile function nerves. So the side effects that you can get from treatment are life-changing. And yes, if you've got a cancer...
Let's spell them out. You could become incontinent.
You could become incontinent. You could have,
Are there any stats on what the chances of becoming incontinent and having to carry a bag around?
Well, the incontinence rates definitely vary between what treatments you're having. If you're having surgery, you know, it could be a 50-50 chance or even higher sometimes. And it really depends on your surgeon, where you're having it done. So the stats are always very dependable upon your surgeon. So you always have to check that out with your local team. But it can be, you know, it can be high. You know, in some areas it could be as high as 60-70% chance. It can be as low as 20-30%. And again, you would
some
have
areas,
to check that
out. Are you talking area postcodes here?
Sometimes it depends on your surgeon, and that is the thing that you would have to ask, because it does depend on how many surgical procedures that your surgeon have performed.
That might be a whole nother topic. We should probably park
that one.
But suffice to say, there's a real chance you could become incontinent. There's another one.
Yeah.
There's a real chance you could become impotent.
There is a much higher chance that you become impotent and that you have erectile dysfunction. And that is with any treatment that you have for prostate cancer, because those erectile nerves surround your prostate. So whether or not you're having surgery to remove your prostate and those nerves might get damaged or even taken away, whether or not you're having radiotherapy and those nerves then are having damage by that radiation, there is every chance that you have, or you're having hormone therapy and it makes your libido totally go. Changes to your sex life are one of the major side effects of prostate cancer treatment. Often with...
Have we got any stats about that?
Stats can be as high as 80% chances of changes to your sex life. And those changes, you know, are life-changing, and most of the time it is for most men, I would say, going through prostate cancer treatment, you don't ever get back to what you once were. You know, those changes, even whatever treatment you have, it never is as good as what things were prior to treatment.
So if you've got a slow growing cancer, and that can be found out with a relatively simple procedure, the choice might be coming down to the potential of being incontinent, impotent, or having to get up once in the night and go for a pee. I'm kind of thinking I know which one I'd be choosing at this point.
And that's exactly it, but it's also making sure that you're having all of that information to fully understand what those reasonings are, because sometimes if you're just given information about you've got cancer, these are your options, and you don't read, understand, you're not explained all of these things when you go to your clinic appointments, sometimes that first initial fear-based decision is, like you said, Mike, at the beginning, I want treatment because I've got cancer. Yeah. So sometimes you can go straight into a fear-based decision without fully understanding what the implications are, and then it's too late. And then you have big treatment regret. And so really fully, men needing to have time in clinics to fully understand, or that's where our charity comes in, to be able to provide that, you know, health information, to provide the specialist nurse service of us being able to take the time to talk to men about these life-changing treatments, so that men fully understand, so that it isn't just a fear-based decision. And it still might be that men choose treatment over surveillance because actually they can't live with that uncertainty. But that's fine if they have that full information first, and not go off of a fear-based decision initially.
But how this decision, which is, you know, a big decision, how's it arrived at the moment? Is it a chat between the surgeon and the patient, or?
Yeah, so often they'll get given, you know, men will be given a diagnosis, and then they will be given their treatment options, and then told to go away and think about what they want to do. So again, it might be a 15, 20 minute conversation. They might be followed up by their specialist nurse to then see what decision they've made, and they might get a chance to speak to a surgeon, an oncologist, about the different treatments, they might not get long where they should be given, you know, some length of time to really decide about this, because you haven't got a fast growing cancer. You know, you really could take as long as you need to make this decision. You know, you could take weeks to make a decision like this, to really make that informed.
Sure. But in the cases where it is the fast growing cancer, it's like, okay, we'll have you in tomorrow kind of deal.
Well, it's still not, you know, prostate cancer, still, even a faster growing cancer, still isn't like another type of cancer, like a bowel or a lung cancer. It still isn't a fast, you know, we need to treat you tomorrow type of cancer. So you still have time, and you might still be given treatment options like surgery or radiotherapy. And so you still need time to make those decisions. And yes, you might be taken down another route and actually told what treatment you need to have, because the cancer maybe is a bit further spread, or, you know, so that there's lots of different options, but prostate cancer still is a different type of cancer than other cancers, and you never need treatment tomorrow. Like, it's a very different type of cancer.
Where does prostate cancer tend to spread to?
So most commonly, prostate cancer spreads to lymph nodes and bones. So that those are the two places it often tends to spread.
All right. So, you know, whatever happens, if there's a chance of that, you need to do something, but maybe not the next day. You still got time to have a really good think, maybe even call Prostate Cancer UK and have a chat to one of the nurses figure it out.
Yeah, because we're there on a helpline. We have a live chat service, an email service, and we're there to be able to give time, and sometimes we can spend an hour on the phone talking to men and partners to be able to go through their, you know, treatment decisions.
Yeah. So, but in generally speaking, to try and get to grips with this potential over-treatment, what needs to happen?
A few things need to happen. One, there needs to be updated guidelines from NICE. The guidelines haven't been changed for many years, and NICE are obviously the kind of the committee that are able to produce guidelines for the whole of the NHS. And because those guidelines haven't been changed, it means that a lot of different hospitals are doing some different things when it comes to those sorts of guidelines.
Right. Presumably because treatment and stuff has marched on considerably.
That's exactly it. Yeah, lots of treatments, and also clinics are very busy, so often there isn't that time that nurses are able to and doctors are able to spend with patients to give
time. Yeah, time is a scarce resource in the NHS. Absolutely,
it is, and so, you know, and that's where men need to understand their decisions and not go off of a fear based factor. There's those couple of things of guidelines need changing, and also kind of men needing that time to make those decisions, and good explanations and good health literature to be able to make those sorts of decisions and not based off of fear.
Okay. I think you covered the topic very nicely. If people are in this situation and they kind of need information, advice, help, what's a good resource for them?
Prostate Cancer UK. You know, all of our website, our health information that we have on our website, as well as information that we can send you in the post. Come into our website, prostatecanceruk.org, phone in our helpline, which is 0800 074 8383. We're open 9 to 5, Monday to Friday. We're there to be able to support anyone that's going through prostate cancer, beginning to end. So whether or not you're just concerned about it or been diagnosed, we're there to be able to support you.
Okay. Give that number again.
So it's 0800 074 8383.
Okay. And if you just search prostate cancer on Google, you'll find you.
Yeah, absolutely.
Excellent. Look, Sophie, thank you so much indeed for taking the time to chat, because, you know, with the numbers of people that actually end up getting this, it's obviously a very important topic. So many thanks.
Oh, my pleasure to be here today. Thank you.
Thank you very much to my guests on this week's show, and they were Dr. Aman Patel, specialist in sexual function and men's health, and Sophie Smith, specialist prostate cancer nurse with Prostate Cancer UK. Please do remember to join me on YouTube on Tuesdays, Thursdays and Friday at 12:30, and come on the exercise bike ride with me. Do remember to vote in the UK Health Radio Awards by going to ukhealthradio.com, and have a healthy week until next week.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Get ready for Malice, a twisted new drama starring Jack Whitehall, David Duchovny, and Carice Van Houten. Jack Whitehall plays Adam, a charming man who infiltrates the wealthy Tanner family with a hidden motive to destroy them. This edge-of-your-seat revenge thriller unravels a deliciously dark mystery in a world full of wealth, secrets, and betrayal. Malice will constantly keep you on your toes. Why is Adam after the Tanner family? What lengths will he go to? One thing's for sure, the past never stays buried, so keep your enemies close. Watch all episodes of Malice on November 14th, only on Prime Video.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Thanks for listening to the Relax Back UK show. Join me, Mike Dilk, again next week for more fascinating interviews and chat. If you're listening to the podcast version, please subscribe, like, and share it with your family and friends. And have a healthy week. Until next week.